was really funny. We decided to move our committee meeting time to 8:15 because we didn't have enough time, and all of us seemed to have forgotten that we did that. So we apologize, Mr. Sager, for keeping you waiting, but I understand a train was keeping you waiting, so it all worked out for the best. We've had the kookiest of winters and the kookiest start of our year, but we'll get in a groove here soon enough, and you'll all wish we went home and never came. But anyway, I'm Vicki Walker, your chair of the Senate Education and General Government Committee. I will remind you what I remind everyone at the beginning of the hearing. Please turn off your cell phone, your BlackBerries, your PDAs, any of those electronic devices. If I hear them go off, you will be making a contribution to the Common School Fund, so which is a good thing, maybe for us, but not your pocketbook. And those contributions get larger as the year goes on. Okay, so we are going to continue with our discussion with the governor's office about their education agenda for the session. Mr. Sager, we had to rudely cut you off last week because we ran out of time. So if you want to get started and finish up, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thank you. Chair Walker, again, for the record, James Sager, governor's office. And I'll try to pick up where we left off the other day and see if I can summarize some things here so we can have a chance to chat a little bit. The next element along the system is to reinvest in the post-secondary system in Oregon. We can have the finest K-12 program in the world, and if we have a second-rate post-secondary system, then we lose the students. They leave the state. We lose the value of their training and their education, and so we have to make sure that the entire education system is properly funded. And so that's why, for instance, in the budget, we have, for the first time in several years, included enrollment growth money and other reinvestments into the post-secondary system to make sure that it is, again, properly supported. And as you heard from Chair Berger the other day, the Joint Boards of Education worked several months with us on prioritizing to make sure that, again, the budget and the policies were lined up correctly, both in this budget as well as the governor asked us to look out to the year 2025 and answer the question, where do we need to be at that time? And so we not only looked at what are the kinds of policy programs and budget issues that we need for the next 2 years, but what do we need for the next 4, 6, 8 years so that we can have a game plan to rebuild the system and make sure that we put the foundation in place this biennium to add to the next biennium and so forth. So there are a number of very strategic decisions made. Just as an example, there is a thread running throughout the enterprise around the healthcare workforce. As we talk about, and the State Board of Ed is going to be, again, dealing today with the high school graduation requirements, as we talk about math and science needs for our high school students, that aligns with the community college university system and OHSU's proposals around healthcare workforce. We know in order to ramp that up, we can do some things immediately by investing in those programs at the post-secondary level, but we need to make sure that the pipeline is properly supported to make sure that we have more and more students that are prepared to enter at the post-secondary level. So there are a number of very strategic investments like that, as well as also investing in the infrastructure of the system. And so, again, a big priority was to make sure that we don't have crumbling facilities and that, in fact, we have the physical capacity to meet the growing need. So what the State Board, or the Joint Boards of Education and the Budget Working Group put together was to say if by 2025 Oregon wants to have 40% of its residents with a four-year higher degree and 40% with an AA or professional certificate, what is that going to take for the state of Oregon to be able to meet that goal? Now, just to clarify, we kind of narrowed it and said, well, let's look at people who today are age 2 to 42, because over the next 18 years, they're the group that'll be ages, you know, 20 to 60. They'll be the prime working group. And so, again, the joint boards is use that kind of material, and we're developing a yield model where we can actually look at it and say, if we put more money into helping our post-secondary system retain more students so that In fact, more students move from freshman to sophomore, sophomore to junior year. What does that mean for the system? How do we both encourage the traditional K-12 pipeline to match up with that, and how do we encourage the current adult workforce to match up with that? So again, it's a very comprehensive look at education. It's not just that kind of traditional students move from K-12 to community college or university and on through the system, because we know that in the post-secondary arena that at many of our schools, the average age of students attending are well over the age of 30. So it's not just that traditional pipeline that's coming in, but in fact it's the adult workforce needing to be retrained or wanting to be retrained and expanding their opportunities. So we have the YIELD model being developed, and we've also asked Nancy Heiligman, who many of you know that has worked for the state for several years. She helped us put together the K-12 database system that we use, and now she is helping us expand that so that we can include the post-secondary system also. So again, we can begin to answer the question, if these are the policies that we need in place in order to help students meet the goals and the aspirations that we have as state and as they have as individuals, then what is the financial commitment that needs to go behind those kinds of policies? We have the quality ed model for the K-12 system that we used very extensively in putting the budget together. We're also looking at trying to devise a similar type of system so we can know what are those strategic investments we need to make in the post-secondary arena also. So with that, I'll stop and, you know, be happy to entertain any questions.
Great. We have some. We'll start with Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, why? How did you come up with a figure of 40%? I think that's an interesting figure. What's the rationale behind that?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, we worked very closely with members of the business community, and the Oregon Business Council was one key player in that, looking at trying to make as good a projection as we can by the year 2025 as to what it's going to take for the state of Oregon to not only be competitive inside the United States, but competitive globally. And so if you look at the type of workforce that we believe is going to be needed, whether you're talking about the plumber or the electrician, or you're talking about the advanced engineering degree, what do we need as a system to be competitive in the global marketplace? And that was the determination that we came up with. If you look at the kinds of jobs, the kinds of training that those jobs require, that's what we came up with as a target. And some think it may be a little beyond our reach, but we believe it's always good to put that target out there a little bit that stretches and challenges us.
Right, well, Madam Chair, just to follow up, and that may be valid, I mean, as targets. I guess I'm looking at folks from my area that have been hired by Intel after a two-year degree, and you know, which is absolutely appropriate. And I guess part of it is 40% is a long ways from where we currently are, getting four-year degrees, and I'm not sure. I guess you're looking at a split. Kind of, I mean, it's 80%, but still 50-50 split, and those going towards probably post-secondary and those getting associate degrees, which is actually more technical training for jobs. And I would almost think that the need for the technical side might be greater than the need for the post-secondary.
Senator Cruz, your point's well taken, and as we adjust this over time, we may discover that it's 35-45 or something of that nature.
Right, right.
Currently, we have about 28% of Oregonians with the four-year higher degree. So, again, it is a stretch for us to talk about that. But we also know from the research that the more students we get into the community college system and they get exposed to a post-secondary environment, more have a tendency to then want to go on and complete a four-year degree, whether it's required for the position or over time the employer says, gee, if you enhance your skills, you know, here's the kind of career ladder for you. So we want to make sure that the system is in place so that those options are available to Oregonians.
Mr. Sager, let me follow up on that, and then I'll take some more questions from the committee, because that was going to be my question as well. One of the things that I appreciate about the governor is that he recognizes not everyone wants to go to college. Right. I mean, that's just not the makeup of some people. They just don't like school. But they like working, they like learning, and they go into the trades. Now, the trades are losing people. The average age of someone in the building trades, welding, electrician, plumbing, all of that, it's in their 40s. So we really need to make sure that we invest in those training programs, too. And there are existing training programs independent of the community colleges that I want to recognize, and I don't want to infringe upon what they're doing. So I'm hoping the governor recognizes that as well. I sense that he does.
Chair Walker, you're absolutely right on the mark, and the governor does. In fact, that's why, I mean, those other training programs are what we include in the 40% that are AA degrees and professional certifications. So a person, whether becoming a licensed plumber, electrician, those require proper certification. Those count. One of the points that the governor has made repeatedly is that with the baby boom generation getting older, that our biggest worry should be the fact that we're not going to have enough plumbers and electricians and people in the trades. And wouldn't that be something if we have to start importing those workers? Those are good family wage jobs. Those are jobs that people can be proud of. And so the governor wants to make sure that we support that in the education enterprise, and so it is very much an integral part of this process.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and can you answer one more question? If you say that we want to get to 40%, what are we at now?
Chair Walker, that's a very good question, and that's part of what the new data system is trying to capture. Number one, we're trying to capture those private sector entities that do contribute, that they don't go through the community college process. The other thing we've discovered is that a community college student in Oregon, unless they actually ask the community college to award an AA degree before or as they transfer to one of our universities, it's not registered as an AA. They may have met the requirement, but they've transferred to the university, they're moving on for their four-year degree, but we don't capture the fact that they just earned an AA. So our numbers need to be improved. And so part of the data system that we're pulling together, in fact, is going to help us begin to capture that so we have a better understanding of where the people are and what we need to do to help.
And why they're dropping out.
And why they're dropping out. Good. Absolutely.
Is it the
economy
or
the program?
Well, that's exactly right. I was hoping that our schools would be doing some exit interviews with people, why they dropped out, because I think that's the only way you're going to find out why they're moving on. Senator Metzger, did you have a question?
No.
Senator Morris? Senator Westland is whispering. I don't think he does. So, Mr. Sager, I really appreciate you coming in. I know we're going to see a lot more of you this session as we move along, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I was just whispering, Madam Chair, how much I enjoyed Jim's testimony. I thought it was riveting, and I wanted I wanted Jeff to be able to know that.
I appreciate that, and Senator Westland, you were not here at our first meeting, so if you want to introduce yourself to our people out here in TV land and the folks here in the room, that would be great. I'll give you that opportunity, and then I'll tell you what we assigned to you while you were gone.
Hi, I'm Senator Ben Westland from District 27. That's functionally all of Deschutes County in Central Oregon. I am very pleased to be here, Madam Chair. I appreciate your leadership on these issues over the years, and I would like to do the mea culpa. I actually thought I was exactly on time for the 8:30 start this morning, and then walking in the door recognized that the agenda said 8:15, so humble apologies.
Well, yes, Senator, because I was sitting here right at 8:15 ready to go. I actually forgot that we had moved it as well. So
maybe you were early.
All right. Well, now that we've done our mea culpas this morning, I'd like to move on with the Oregon Student Association. We have a presentation from Melissa Unger, the executive director, and I'm sure she's going to bring some folks up. So come on down.
Morning.
Good morning. Just introduce yourself, please.
Sure. Well, firstly, I'd like to say, Chair Walker and members of the committee, thank you for allowing the Oregon Student Association the opportunity to talk with you today. I'm Courtney Morris. I'm a student at Portland State University, as well as vice chair for OSA.
And my name is Laura Nalanderos. I am part of the Oregon Students Color Coalition, and I'm a fourth year at the University of Oregon.
Go Ducks. Yeah. We're doing great in basketball this year.
Not so good in football, though.
And I'm Melissa Unger, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Student Association. And Bill's going to continue to speak as we figure out the PowerPoint presentation over here.
Okay, great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I'm very honored to be able to speak with you about our legislative agenda, but first let me give you an opportunity to tell you why and how we came to decide our agenda. For an entire year, we students debated what the most important issues were facing us as students, and we came up with a recipe for a stronger Oregon. Before we give our ingredients for that recipe, however, we'd like to take a couple of minutes to give you a background. In 1965, President Johnson signed the Higher Education Act, saying it means that a high school senior anywhere in this great land of ours can apply to any college or any university in any of the 50 states and not be turned away because his family is poor. He continued to say, "I want you to go back and say to your children and to your grandchildren and those who come after you and follow you, tell them that we have made a promise to them and tell them that we have opened the road and we have pulled the gates down and the way is open and we expect them to travel it." When President Johnson signed the Higher Education Act, it provided a $1,000 Pell Grant to any student who qualified completely based on need. Today, 40 years later, the Pell Grant is $4,050, which is a 305% increase. While it seems like a large increase, it pales in comparison to tuition increases of the past 40 years. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, total tuition fees and room and board at a four-year university was $1,105 in 1965. Today, at an Oregon University, tuition fees, room and board is approximately $14,000, which is a 1,170% increase since 1965.
Wow.
We are at a crossroads in Oregon. We can continue on the track that we are on and be 46th in the nation for funding post-secondary education, with the largest decrease in funding in the nation since 1991, or we can do what other states are doing and prioritize post-secondary education to ensure the future strength of our state. By 2010, 87% of new jobs in Oregon will require a college degree, and to meet this demand, we must begin to reinvest and prioritize post-secondary education. My buddy Johnny Ozemkowski from Portland State University, he was lobbying in the Capitol last Wednesday, and he told a story to the legislators that I think clearly illustrates why students are frustrated and looking for solutions. So he couldn't be here today, and I wanted to take the chance to tell his story. Johnny is a student from Ashland who qualifies for some aid but is about $500 short of qualifying for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. He has to work to pay for school and has a tough time making ends meet. He's crashed on my couch a couple of times, actually. Tuition is so high that he can't afford his textbooks. He and 9 other friends went in to buy textbooks together because his financial aid and paycheck was not enough for tuition and books. While this story illustrates the length students have to go to pay for tuition, I think the more upsetting part of this story is that he went to class on Tuesday at Portland State University and was forced to sit on the floor. Johnny, just like myself and the other 90,000 students in Oregon universities, are paying $5,000 to $6,000 for tuition and fees to get an education when he has to go to the class, and there weren't enough chairs for everyone that was signed up. So he sat in the corner on the floor for 2 hours. Johnny will be heavily in debt for an education that he sat on the floor for. This is frustrating, but the piece that makes me most upset is that I know if I were 5 years older, I would have paid $3,000 to $4,000 for a college education, and I would have been able to sit in a chair. Plain and simple, Oregon over the past 5 years has balanced a state budget on the backs of students. Legislators looked at students as a revenue source and disproportionately cut universities and community colleges compared to other state programs because they believe that students would make up the difference. While tuition has skyrocketed, universities and community colleges have still been forced to make cuts such as increasing class sizes, cutting student services, foregoing filling faculty and staff positions, and cutting courses and departments to balance their budgets. Literally, we are paying more and getting less. For the students that are in school and going $20,000 into debt, this is maddening. As a first-generation college student with little help from my parents, I have struggled with the thought to drop out of college. With expensive alternative loans, my debt is adding up, and my current interest rate for a Sallie Mae loan is 14.25%.
I'm sorry, how much?
Yeah, I'll say that again, 14.25%.
For a Sallie Mae loan?
Correct. And I can get those records for you.
That's 14.25%.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money for a government-backed loan.
Yeah, I agree.
That's why I'm a little surprised about that.
You didn't go to a payday lender for that, did you?
Yeah.
If you want to help assist me with that interest rate, that'd be awesome.
Hey, it's lower than our credit cards. I mean, come on. Yeah.
It's true. But even with this burden, I have decided to pursue my education because it's too important to me. I ask that if I have to invest into my future with such personal risk, that the Oregon legislature do their part and invest into a quality education. It is frustrating to know that we college-educated citizens will be the backbone of the state's economy, and the state has done little to ensure that our money will be well spent. While I have risked a lot to be here, I feel lucky that I am here. One of the most disturbing trends that has happened over the last 5 years is enrollment has dropped. At a time when college degree means more for the state and for the individual than ever before, for the first time in over a decade, resident enrollment actually decreased 1.2% at universities. While overall enrollment was steady because of out-of-state students, Oregon's universities enrolled less Oregonians in 2006 than in 2005. At community colleges, enrollment has been plummeting for the past 3 years because of tuition increases and program cuts. Community college enrollment dropped during a recession when many people should have been looking at them as a place for training and job development. At a time when a college degree is more important than ever before for our state to attract business and build a strong tax base, we are educating less Oregonians. While all students have felt the impact of the state's disinvestments, students of color, low-income students, and rural students are especially hurt by the cuts and increase in tuition. Students from family incomes below $25,000 are 40% less likely to attend college than students with family income above $75,000. White students are twice as likely to enroll in college than Latinos and African Americans. And while 31% of 18 to 24-year-olds overall attend college in Oregon, only 14% of rural Oregonians 18 to 24 are attending college. For the students that do go to college, they are more likely to drop out because of tuition increases and cuts in student services. So while the state's disinvestment has hurt everyone, it is the students that President Johnson once promised an open gate for that are most impacted. While we believe that open gate has been blocked in Oregon, we hope that our recipe for a stronger Oregon will begin the process of removing some of these roadblocks. It is all these problems that brought us to choose our recipe for a stronger Oregon. To come up with our priorities for this session, we surveyed over 6,000 students at institutions across the state and did extensive research on the issues most pertinent to students' lives, and finally students chose 4 issues to address the issues of access, retention, and quality for post-secondary education in Oregon, which we hope will create a real change for Oregonians working to attain a degree. Thank you.
The first ingredient in the recipe for a stronger Oregon is to further invest...
Oh, I'm sorry. You'll have to state your name again for the record.
My name is Lorena Landeros. The first ingredient in the recipe for a stronger Oregon is to further invest in the Oregon Opportunity Grant to address the issues of affordability and access. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, our state's only need-based aid program, attempts to eliminate the growing gap between who's able to attend college. While the legislature made historic investment in the program last session, we are far from President Johnson's goal of opening the doors of universities and colleges to all citizens. The Opportunity Grant, despite the investment made in 2005, serves only the neediest of students with a small, flat grant that is arbitrarily based on 11% of the cost of education. We're failing to offer adequate grant aid at a time when Oregonians with the lowest 20% of incomes are having to pay 83% of their income to send a child to a state university. For today's students, working your way through college is only a myth. Oregon's universities and community college students would have to work 48 and 39 hours per week, respectively, to pay for the cost of their education. Unable to work their way through, low-income and middle-income students are left with the options of borrowing to attend college or not attend at all. According to the Department of Education, Oregon students depend on loans to attend school at higher rates than any other state in the country, leaving with an average of nearly $20,000 debt for a four-year degree. Personally, I'm already $15,000 in debt and with a year and a half left of my college education. This session, the legislator has the opportunity to close this affordability gap and ensure that I can get my degree. The governor, student, universities, community colleges, and other interested parties have worked together since last session to create the shared responsibility model, a new model for need-based aid in Oregon that would restore the opportunity grant to its original mission. For the first time, the state of Oregon would outline what is expected of all parties involved in a student education, the student and his or her family, the federal government, and the state. Under the model, students would once again be able to work their way through school, and families would be able to plan for the future, as generations before us have done. I want to take a second to share my own story. I've been a recipient of the Oregon Opportunity Grant for the past 3 years. Because my parents made a little more than all the previous years, my grant was taken away. My parents are still unable to help me financially to fund for my education, so I had to find other means to make up for the Oregon Opportunity Grant used to make. I was forced to take out loans and find extra work hours to make up that to cover the expenses. The shared responsibility model helps to solve this problem by making sure that I wouldn't lose my grant just because my parents made a little bit more than the cutoff. Under the model, which would be facilitated by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, students make the initial investment in their education through reasonable work hours and borrowing, with families contributing what they are able. If students and families fulfill the requirements that the state expects of them, the state will then step in, where the federal government does not, to fill the affordability gap. Instead of awarding arbitrary flat grants to all students, the shared responsibility model would award grants based on income, with more assistance going to our state's neediest students. Financial eligibility would be extended to middle-income families. Projections show that students for families with incomes up to $60,000 per year would receive grants. Providing aid to the middle class is a necessary step. As tuition has increased, middle-class Oregonians have had little to no relief. Shared responsibility model funding is sufficient to provide average grant amounts of about $1,800 for approximately 42,000 students in 2008-2009. This greatly expands the population of students served, and initial numbers have indicated that a fully phased-in shared responsibility model could increase enrollment at our institution by 3,775 students that will not have enrolled without the additional aid. This model represents the kind of values Oregonians can get behind, offering the opportunity of a post-secondary education to anyone who is willing to work for it, resulting in a stronger, better Oregon for the future. The governor's budget includes all necessary funding and resources to implement this model by 2009.
Thanks, Lorna. Our second ingredient for a stronger Oregon education is funding, an issue that was chosen to address the real situation that students are paying more and receiving less. We believe the state can't continue to ask students to pay for an education that the state won't invest in. States across the country are investing in post-secondary education, and Oregon needs to do the same. The return for our state is undeniable. Every 1,000 new Oregon citizens who graduate from college means nearly $62 million additional tax dollars for state-funded systems and programs, such as schools and public services. Not only do they contribute more in taxes, they attract businesses, they are healthier, more civically engaged, and less likely to rely on state services. The governor's recommended budget is a great first step toward rebuilding our state's university system. Since 1991, Oregon has had the fifth largest tuition increase in the nation. The governor's recommended budget would keep increases to no more than increases in the median family income, ensuring that tuition does not outpace a family's ability to pay. The governor's budget also starts the process of reinvesting in universities by funding the student-faculty ratios, faculty salaries, rural universities, and enrollment growth. While we believe the governor's recommended budget is a strong investment, we are interested in working on the issue dealing with interest on tuition. In the past, the interest from tuition has been rolled into the general fund, something that students have opposed. The governor has proposed giving the interest dollars to the university system, which we support, but he also reduced the general fund by $19 million because of the increase the university will have in tuition dollars. While this doesn't impact the budget in dollars and cents, we believe that it does continue the trend of shifting the burden of funding for higher education to the student. It was less than 20 years ago that student paid 35% the cost of education, and the state paid for 65%. Just 7 years ago, it closed to 50-50. Today, students fund approximately 62%, while the state funds 38%. Students will be asking that we keep the interest earnings on tuition and also keep the $19 million in general fund to begin to reverse the trend and make students and the state equal partners in funding for higher education again. Another important aspect in rebuilding Oregon's higher education system is addressing our damaged community college system. Oregon's 17 community colleges are critical in training our citizens for family wage jobs and providing local businesses with a trained workforce. Stating this investment in our community colleges over the past decade has closed the door of access for many who need it the most, evident most in drastic decline in enrollment. From 2003 to 2004, Oregon's community colleges enrolled 47,000 fewer students than the previous year. Now is the time to reinvest and rebuild. OSA is asking the legislature to fund the community colleges with $46 million above the governor's recommended budget. With full funding, our colleges will be able to keep tuition increases as low as possible, offer professional and technical programs necessary for a trained workforce, and better serve adults and non-traditional students by expanding night and weekend classes. Fully funding the community college's budget will also allow increased distance education for those unable to get to campuses, improve access and service for disabled students, and increase enrollment. Do I have one more there? In addition to investing in our community colleges and universities, OSA is also working to ensure that OHSU receives the funding that the governor allocated in its budget. The budget for OHSU expands the amount of in-state medical students, the ability for dental students to work in their communities, and includes funding for an additional 100 nursing students. This is necessary investment to ensure that Oregonians can attend Oregon's only medical and dental school. Can't forget OHSU.
Sorry, Kurt.
No worries.
Our third ingredient for a strong Oregon is expanding the ASPIRE program, which we believe is the solution to the problems of access and preparation. ASPIRE, which stands for Access to Student Assistant Programs in Reach of Everyone, is a unique volunteer-based program that helps Oregon high school students plan for their future. At a time when Oregon's high schools are far behind the national average in providing counselors for their students, ASPIRE seeks to fill this void. One-on-one mentoring programs are what experts claim are the most effective, which is exactly what ASPIRE is. It matches mentors with students to walk them through the financial aid process and college application process. ASPIRE mentors have seminars for students and parents about how to apply and receive aid and scholarships. Parents of high school students, especially low-income, first-generation, and students of color, overestimate the cost of tuition by as much as 3 times. Without any information, families believe a college education is out of reach. The ASPIRE program empowers families with options and information so that they can realize the dream of an education. ASPIRE, although never having received state funding, is currently in 86 of Oregon's 317 high schools because of grants through AmeriCorps and other foundations, and it has been proven successful time after time. At Ashland High School, 1 year after the program was introduced, school officials reported a 12% jump in graduating seniors indicating their plans to attend post-secondary education after graduation. For ASPIRE to expand, the state must make an investment. The governor's budget, for the first time ever, includes state funding to expand the ASPIRE program from 86 to 150 high schools in Oregon. While this is a great first step, OSA is asking the legislature for an additional $1.7 million above the governor's recommended budget to fully fund this program, allowing it to expand to 285 high schools. This would guarantee that all Oregon high schools that are interested have the opportunity to offer the program to their students. ASPIRE works to make sure that all students, no matter their background or parents' education, have access to information about college. Our last priority ingredient for a stronger Oregon is past tuition equity. Tuition equity describes a bill that was introduced in 2003 that would allow in-state tuition for all students who attend an Oregon high school for 3 years, graduate, and are accepted in an Oregon university, regardless of their immigration status. As Oregon grows and our demographics change, it is imperative that we focus on educating all students that graduate and succeed in high school. It is not in the best interest of Oregon to turn away bright and motivated students that want to give back to our state by getting a college degree. 10 other states, including our neighbors to the north and south, have taken the steps of passing similar legislation to ensure that they provide the opportunity of a college education to all of their best and brightest. Students that would qualify for an in-state tuition under this bill have often attended Oregon schools for most of their life. They have built friendships, worked hard for good grades, played sports, and been active members of the community, but they are forced to pay out-of-state tuition, which is 3 times higher than in-state tuition, because of something that is out of their control. Many of these students plan on staying in Oregon and are working towards a residency, but aren't able to enroll in our universities because of their family's documentation status. To ensure that we are meeting the demands of the state and allowing all students access to college that want it, we must pass tuition equity and do what is right for our state. In addition to our 4 legislative priorities, we are also looking at what the state can do to solve some of the problems that students are facing because of the increasing cost of textbooks, the use of resources fees at the universities, a lack of childcare, access to voting, and student debt. In conclusion, we believe that we can make Oregon stronger by investing in our institutions and in our students. When President Johnson signed the Higher Education Act, a college education was not necessary for a family to make a living wage. In 1965, all wages were still increasing. Yet today, when a college education is more important than ever for individuals, the state, and our country, we are investing less than ever before. Our goal is that in 2009, we can say that this is no longer true.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. I always expect excellence from OSA, and we always get it. Unfortunately, we're having technical difficulties, so we're not going to be able to take a look at your PowerPoint presentation, but we do have that in written form, and we'll take a look at it. Are any questions here from the committee? Senator Westland?
Just a comment. Madam Chair, similar along the vein of which you were going, is I am just always impressed with the caliber of student that comes to these dais. I don't care if it's K-12, community college, four-year. I didn't have the capacity or the capability of doing that when I was your age, and so...
You still don't.
Compliments. Well, you know, this is the truth. Every one of us sitting behind this dais, when we testify on our bills in support or opposition to someone else's bill, we're always nervous when we sit there. You guys did a great job. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you. We'll look forward to working with you. I'm sure we'll see a number of these, all four of your issues come through this committee, and thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Okay. Thank you so much. We're going to move right along, and we have a presentation from the Workforce 2005 Task Force, Deborah Barnes, if you want to come up. I think we're going to have to shorten that. We have that scheduled for 30 minutes, but I think we're going to try to do that in 20.
We'll probably do it in less.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ms. Barnes.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, first off, thank you for allowing us to have the Workforce 2005 Task Force. It was because of your committee and your work that allowed us to do that. I'm Deborah Barnes. I have a couple of hats. I work for the North Clackamas School District at the Sabin-Schellenberg Professional Technical Center, where I've worked as a teacher there for the past 12 years in broadcasting. I was also the vice chair of the Workforce Task Force 2005, and I'm currently working with Senator Schrader to propose a Workforce 2007 Task Force based on our work over 5 months and about 6 meetings. What if you had a class that allowed students to obtain college credits, higher SIM scores in reading and math, meet and understand all SIM work samples, complete at least 2 career-related learning standards and experiences per year, achieve credit in language arts, science, and math, U.S. history, complete an internship, and then go on to a 95% rate of going on to post-secondary education? That would seem like the ideal educational experience for high school students in Oregon, and it is actually happening at the Sabin-Schellenberg Center in the North Clackamas School District. It's called Career and Technical Education, where students learn by doing. They don't have a worksheet. They don't have lectures. They come into the classroom, and they get to work because they know it is relevant, it is rigorous, and there are relationships where business and industry come together with educators to plan curriculum, to provide internships, to give us ideas of the future of what those workplaces should look like and what those workforce members should be. I used to spend my time as a professional broadcaster, a newscaster in the state of Oregon, and cover the legislature and watch school districts try to manage their budgets with what they had. When I became a teacher, I realized firsthand the importance of funding for education and learned even more clearly that students learn by doing. There's no such thing as problems when it comes to kids coming in with student management difficulties in our school because kids want to be there. Kids stay after school not because they have to, because we have to push them out at 5 o'clock saying, the school is over with, you need to go home. That's the best part of education, when the kids learn by doing and they want to learn and they see the relationship between the math in their classroom, and they don't say to me, well, why do we need to learn this? Because they want to learn. What we learned with the Workforce Task Force is Oregon, quite frankly, is well behind our neighboring states when it comes to funding CTE education. Washington, in the last session, spent millions of dollars funding new programs, starting new centers, upgrading equipment, starting new programs. California, the exact same thing, millions of dollars. I sent our final report to all of you on this committee because I needed you to see the complexity of what we're dealing with. If we invest those same dollars in Oregon education now, students will get why they're learning, what they're learning, and that better prepares them for the workforce of tomorrow, and in addition, they get college credit at the same time. It's a win-win. It's like a Fred Meyer shopping center. When you go in, you get everything at once. The Workforce Task Force has a lot of priorities, but we've narrowed them down to 5. The So number one would be a study that needs to be a lot more complex. We have data to show you what happens in Clackamas County and how CTE students continue to outpace their counterparts, not only in Clackamas County, but statewide when it comes to SIM scores. If a kid takes classes at our center, we can show data that proves that they have higher test scores in writing, reading, and math than their counterparts in Clackamas County and the state. So we are requesting $250,000 for not only a more comprehensive study, so we can come back and give the legislature the needed details of why we are not keeping pace with our counterparts throughout the nation, showing that this kind of education actually proves beneficial to not only students, but to our own investment of state dollars. We are working with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is now on board, helping us tone whatever we need to do to get this legislation through and the priorities straight. So I want to go over just a few details so we're all on the same page of what we're looking at. Marketing and consistency. Right now, if a student takes one of our classes, the majority of parents don't know there's college credit. The Oregon Department of Education is now putting through a pilot program where they're spending money so that there is one name for career and technical education in Oregon. Some folks call it PTE, some folks call it vocational ed. We're career and technical education, and that happens at the national level. We're one of the only states left that doesn't call it career and technical education on a formal basis. We also need a marketing program so that students, teachers, and most importantly, parents realize that when students take one of our classes, there is college credit available to them. My students get 12 college credits for $60 through Mount Hood Community College, $60 total for those 12 college credits. Imagine how much savings that would be for the parent across this state, because that's part of the articulation agreement every professional technical, or we hope career and technical ed program, has in the state of Oregon because of the Carl Perkins funding. We also think that the student leadership program in Salem should continue to be funded. ODE is coming up with $760,000 out of their budget. But wouldn't it be great if a business in Bend was able to call one number and say, we have employees that would like to work with the programs at your school, but they don't know how to reach the right person in the school district? Why not have one number in the state of Oregon? It's a 1-800 number that matches up employers with school districts, so they can work together to provide internships, job shadows, and the like. We'd like to see that happen. We need to establish a PTE education program that would provide a Bachelor of Arts in Technology or a Bachelor of Arts in Science Technology. So instead of having a regular BS degree, you can go into the higher ed if you'd like to have tech in your background and obtain a degree in that way. We are working with a pilot program now. OIT has stepped forward and said they would be willing to do that. The bottom line is, this is an important part of education in Oregon. And ODE is now on board. I've chatted with them. I've worked with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. They are willing to work with us. The governor's office, James Seger, and I have chatted. We've learned that this is important education in Oregon. However, we need a detailed study to give you data. I understand data. I'm also the city council member in Milwaukee, so I expect data in front of me. You need to have the same kind of data that shows the importance of why we think you should continue to fund and expand your funding for not only places like the Sabin-Schellenberg Center in Oregon, because we're one of only very few professional technical centers in the state of Oregon, but nearly every high school in this state has some kind of CTE class. Those programs are costly because we should give kids the closest we can to state-of-the-art education with equipment that is the same as industry standards. That way, kids are more prepared for the workforce because they've already worked on it. Finally, I know this works because one of my own students who graduated from our program about 7 years ago is now the chief editor of the show Las Vegas in NBC. He came back a year ago and walked into my classroom and said, guess what? I make more money than you. And I said, guess what? You're welcome. Bottom line is, I know that you're difficult with dollars. I know what that's like. But if I can show you with data that every dollar you put into CTE means you have a kid ready to go out into the workforce or go on to college and has the basics of what those employers need in the long term, that's an investment you can't pass up.
Well, and I understand that because we've had your students in here before, and it's always a pleasure to hear from them and the successes of your program, so I appreciate that. Thank you. Did any of you have any questions of Ms. Barnes? Okay, well, I'm glad that you came to us on short notice to talk to us about your priorities, and you did deliver a copy of your report to all of us. So we will have conversations with Senator Schrader about his work trying to move forward on some of these ideas, and we'll see you again later in the session.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, thank you, Ms. Barnes. Okay, colleagues, now we are going to go into bill hearings. And I apologize, at one point on our agenda, we did have these scheduled for possible work session, and we had to make so many changes to the agenda with the snow, it got dropped. So if we feel inclined to move any of these bills today, we won't be able to do it, but we'll be able to move them as quickly as we can at our next hearing. So we're going to start out with Senate Bill 70. And we're going to have Chuck Hibner of the Audits Division come in and testify about Senate Bill 70. Oh, yes, and you know, it takes us a while just to relearn everything. Usually what we have is the committee administrator tell us a little bit about the bill before you testify, so I'm going to have Dana Richardson do that. And I also need to gavel into a public hearing. So we're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 70. You know, they need a refresher course for us. Ms. Richardson, can you give us all a heads up about what this bill's about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 70 does three or four distinct things. It changes for semi-independent state agencies and Oregon Tourism Commission, the department would conduct financial reviews rather than audits of those agencies. Additionally, it would delete the requirement that the secretary audit or review state agencies when agency directors retire. Thirdly, it would delete the requirement that the secretary post audit disbursements from the Department of Veterans Affairs conservatorship revolving account. And lastly, it would repeal the requirement that the secretary audit accounts of sheriffs who perform services for the state. That, in brief, is what Senate Bill 70 would do.
Great. And you all have a staff measure summary that we are quite used to, and Ms. Richardson does an excellent job with that. So with that, Mr. Hibner, you also have a guest.
Good morning, Chair Walker, committee members. I'm Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division. With me is Elon Hassan with our executive department.
Okay.
Good bill. Should pass.
Richardson did such a great job describing what the bill was like. I was trying to figure out where I wanted to start, but maybe just to give you a little bit of background on this Senate Bill 70. It is a reintroduction of a bill, something that was introduced last session that didn't. You had a lot of things on your plate, so it just didn't get a lot of traction to move ahead. But it was something that was born out of the Joint Legislative Audits Committee interest in helping us with some of the things, some of the mandated audits that we thought were a little bit not as necessary as maybe they were at a given time. And so it really was, the bill was introduced by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee the first time through. In this last interim, when we were discussing our legislative priorities, I brought it back to the table and asked the Joint Legislative Audit Committee for this last interim if it's something that we would like to introduce, because I figured there was still some discussion to be done on that, whether they would like to introduce it or just have us introduce it here, which obviously the latter was fine, and here we are. The bill, in brief, is discussing some of the mandates that we face, and I guess in sum, eliminating some of the mandates that may not be quite as important to us as some other things we'd like to do, free up the resources to allow us to do those sorts of things. And that's really what I think we're addressing here in this bill. As far as the first bullet point, and I do believe you have written testimony there, which I won't read back to you verbatim, but the first item, which deletes the requirement for the change of director audits, there is a statutory requirement that whenever an agency head leaves that we go in and perform a review or an audit, and we've been doing that for quite some time now, and we did put some facts and figures in there. There was a three-year span where we were doing a lot of them. It was a particularly busy time for agency heads to be retiring, I guess. But we, as you can see, we performed during that three-year span 47 of these, and it cost a significant amount of money. What we felt we got during that time was not a lot, really. There weren't a lot. I mean, you got some affirmation that things were okay, but we weren't really seeing a lot of problems with that. And I know there is some... There is a case to be made that the deterrent effect of these things, and I know that one senator in particular, Senator Ferraioli, has expressed an interest in keeping this in place because of the deterrent effect. You know, there's a case to be made for that. However, eliminating this provision from the law would not keep us from doing that. I mean, we would still have the right or obligation, or however you want to look at that, to go in and look at a change of director scenario if that is indeed what we would like to do. Typically, we do audits based on risk. So if we think there's a particularly risky situation, be it the retirement of a director or when they're still in office or whatever, we would go in and look at those sorts of things if it's felt necessary. Having that as a trigger for an audit, a moment in time when someone leaves an office, just we don't really operate that way. We do because it's a statute, but everything we do is based on risk. So if it's a risky situation, we can still go in and do the audit. If not, then not, and we can use those resources to do other things. So in sum, it's a long sum, but in sum, that was kind of the crux behind that, the discussion we had during the prior interim and this interim. And either we can move on to the next bullet point or handle questions here now if you like.
I think Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, and just kind of tracking the history last session when that provision was removed with a 5-0 vote. So I can understand where mandating it in all cases may not necessarily make sense, but... I guess my question is, when I look at the members who are on that committee, is removing this going to create issues as it moves through the process? That's, you got the majority leader of the Senate who thought that removing that provision, that's all House, isn't it? Okay. Okay, I mean, why did they remove that provision last time in the House?
Senator Walker, Chair Cruz, I'm not sure I know. I wasn't the director at that time. Kathy Polina was helping these bills through the process at that time, and I don't recall why the House removed that provision. I wasn't even aware they did, so
okay.
I apologize for that.
It seems reasonable to me that they shouldn't, it shouldn't be necessarily prescriptive and they do it based on risk, but I was just trying to get a sense of the legislative history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish I had an answer for it. I apologize. I don't know.
Well, maybe we can get an answer from the committee notes.
Okay.
I think that might be helpful to us.
That's something you'd like us to provide?
No, I think Ms. Richardson
okay.
can get that to us.
Okay.
A little easier than you can.
That would be my guess, too.
Okay.
Do you want to move on to the second
sure.
provision, which would change the requirement for some of the semi-independent agencies and right now they're required to have an audit, and the semi-independents are fairly small in a lot of cases, and in working with them for a number of years and getting a feel, we hope, for the sort of information that seems to be important when they're being reported back to you folks and others. A review of revenues and expenditures. This is an agreed upon procedure where a CPA can come in and really do a smaller attestation as to the revenues and expenditures, and providing that report is probably really the value you're looking for, and not a full blown audit report or an opinion on their financial statements, which is more costly. If we felt, as the oversight agency in this, that an audit really was something that was needed to be done, this would not remove our ability to require that. It just would allow the flexibility on the lower end for those that to do the lesser cost review in most cases, and allow them to spend that money in other places. That really is that provision.
Okay.
And then the third one. Is getting rid of a couple mandates. There's a particular Department of Veterans Affairs revolving account which has a requirement that we audit it every year. I'm sure at the time that was instituted there was a really good story as to why it was put in there. We don't see the necessity of it now. We go in, we do it. There's no findings of significance, if at all. It's just, again, one of those requirements that if we didn't have to do it, we don't consider it high risk. If at any point we felt it was high risk, we'd go back in and do it again. It doesn't, in our eyes, it doesn't have to be mandated for us to consider it significant and then do it if it's warranted. And the other provision, which is auditing the subaccount of a sheriff when they are required to perform services on behalf of the state, I didn't even know existed until it was brought up, and I don't know of many sheriffs that do this, number one. And again, I'll bet there's a great story as to why that was passed some time ago, probably for a particular sheriff in a particular county. But again, we don't see the necessity of it now, and it's really a non-functioning provision. And while we're doing a cleanup, that might be good to just have that eliminated.
Okay.
And that is it. Obviously, we support the bill. We felt that the process was good. We got help from the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and the members of that committee in crafting what we think is some good legislation, and we'd like to see it move forward.
All right. Mr. Hasson, did you have any comment?
Nope.
Okay. And you are from the Secretary of State's
office. I am from Elon Hasson from the Secretary of State's office. I'm the legislative policy advisor. The only other thing I'd add is that this was pretty much viewed in our office as one of our cleanup bills, which we try and keep pretty good sideboards on. These have the least, if any, policy implications of them. We really try and make them something that is fairly benign on a policy level. And I think this is our only audits cleanup housekeeping bill.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think what I'll do is have Ms. Richardson find out what happened to that one provision last session, mm-hmm. so that we have that information, and then we'll bring this back and see what we can do with it.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
No question, but I guess, Madam Chair, I just looked at the makeup of the committee last session and noting that the Speaker Pro Tem was on that committee, and just wanting to make sure that we're not, that we hopefully can send a clean bill out. I personally have no issues. I just need to find out what concerns were.
And I think that's very appropriate. And question with Senator Metzger.
Well, no, I just might make a comment. I would suspect, without reviewing the tape myself, I would suspect that a concern would probably be, because this would be a concern I would have, is that you have language that removes this mandatory requirement, and on one hand you say that's correct. I mean, obviously, in all circumstances, you can't say that that's always going to be a good use of resources. On the other hand, there's nothing in the bill and the removal that gives any confidence that you are going to conduct at least some audits or a standard of review that might trigger, and it's more, so it's more of a leap of faith that, by the way, we're not just going to totally lose that function. And my only thought would be, you know, is there something that you could add to the bill that increases the confidence level of either the fact that, you know, some audits would be done on a revolving account, or that when you do a financial review that might trigger an audit, that there's something in the language of the bill that gives, I think, the legislative body confidence that we're not totally going to be relying on the whoever is leading the department at that particular time's word that they will still provide proper oversight. And I think with the deletion but no addition to that language might be a reason why the committee would step back a little bit and say, yeah, this is too cumbersome, but this is basically only a leap of faith. Is there somewhere in between that we could have some confidence that the function is being performed?
Yeah, Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, I agree. It is a leap of faith, but you can trust me, honest. yeah, you know, functionally, probably having some sort of a, if you can, sort of provision in the bill probably wouldn't affect how we function. I think what you're probably talking about is kind of some sort of reporting mechanism that would allow the number of these we do a year, report back or whatever. I don't know.
Right. Well, I think you're on the right.
I haven't given any thought.
I think you're on the right. You know, track something that,
but
you know, we feel like we have a fiduciary duty. We want to make sure that if something goes wrong, you know, no one wants to be called by, you know, to find out how come you took away that and didn't take away and didn't have some type of oversight.
I can read my phone number to the record if you like, and you can just call me if you have any questions.
Well, you may not be here next year or the year after that, right? So.
I'll turn our best guy loose on it and see what we can.
Okay.
Okay, I think that's a good point. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Cruz?
Yeah, I agree with Senator Metzger that there may be some language, but I guess what I looked at was the revolving door in DHS over the last few biennia, and every time, every 6 months when there's a new director, you're required to do an audit of an agency that size seems on the surface ridiculous. So, or an expenditure of a lot of resources.
It's been a good customer.
Yeah. sort of thing. So I think allowing flexibility is what I see, what we're trying to get here, but maybe we can come up with some language that satisfies that. So
happy to work with you on that.
Okay, well, I'll set you to work on that. We'll get the other information from Ms. Richardson, and then we'll bring this back a little bit later.
Okay.
Any other questions? Senator Westland?
I mean, I appreciate the testimony and conversation here this morning, but at the same time, what I do remember from those hearings, and specifically from Kathy Polino, was only, you know, if I'm retiring, I would really want an audit, just so there was no questions whatsoever come up 4 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line that could implicate me in, you know, something that went on in the department that I was unaware of at the time. Just a question, Chuck. I mean, you're retiring tomorrow. Would you want an audit or not? I mean, doesn't that give you some comfort and security as you ride off to your well-earned retirement?
Senator Westland, Chair Walker. Yes, I suppose so. And we would certainly consider if an agency had, as they were retiring or leaving for whatever reason, were to ask that we do our standard change of director sort of review, we would certainly consider that. And I think we tend to be more responsive than not. But we would have to evaluate it, and to be honest with you, as to whether that is a good place to put the resources at that moment in time. But I think we tend to be fairly responsive to those sorts of things, but there would be no mandate around that, for sure.
Right. And I suppose that goes back to Senator Metzger's comments that, you know, in some cases it would just be, you know, totally uncalled for and not necessary. But if I'm the retiring, you know, chief of whatever, director of whatever, I mean, it would give me comfort to know that when I walked out of that office door, that was it. So, anyway.
There you have it this morning.
Okay.
We are an active group. Senator Morse has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with the comments about making sure that we're not becoming too loose. But I wonder if, rather than trying to add statute, if you might think about where in the statute you could direct us and point out where your authority does exist and how you manage risk based on your judgment, which is really what this bill, as I read it, does. It allows you, instead of a mandatory, you're able to manage these accounts on a risk basis. If there's language that would give us that comfort that's been expressed, that's already existing.
Mm-hmm. Senator Walker, Chair Walker, Senator Morris, it is early in the session.
I'll yeah, I know you're going to get that down.
Yeah. Are you referring specifically to potentially the language in this bill?
Well, what I said
or just our general audit authority?
Yeah, Madam Chair, what I sensed was that maybe we were looking for an amendment to put just a little bit of comfort back in it, and I'm not sure how we would write that. Mm-hmm. In the alternative, if there is existing statute that gives you the authority to manage these accounts based on risk, to what degree would that give us comfort?
Good point.
And Chair Walker, Senator Morris, I think that this provision being deleted would default us back to our constitutional role and responsibility as the auditor of public accounts. I don't know that there's specific legislation that, or anything stemming from that that would dictate how we go about performing our work in terms of evaluating risk and those sorts of things. I don't know that it exists. I don't know that it doesn't, but you know, I'm not thinking of what it might be.
Okay, I'm going to have Ms. Richardson work with you on seeing what's out there and seeing what language we can pull together to satisfy the committee.
But, okay, Chair Walker, I do understand that we're talking about kind of a reporting sort of issue here, or are we beyond that now? I want to try to understand exactly what it is we're...
Senator Cruz?
I think, listening to everybody here, and Senator Westland made some very good points, and, you know, if I was a state agent, head of state agency, and I wanted an audit, and you said you would consider it. I'm wondering if there needs to be a mechanism in there where, or as a legislator, I have some concerns over somebody who's retiring and would like to know what's going on there, if there needs to be some mechanism whereby a request would drive it from either the head of the agency or somebody from the Legislative Assembly. I mean, would that, Senator Metzger, does that
I think we need to work on it a little bit, but I think, you know, we've got some thoughts out here, and I'd be happy to noodle it a little bit and work with Dan on my ideas, but they're not really crystallized at the moment.
I think anything that is a mandate similar to this. I mean, I don't know that if we were talking about a mandate that this wouldn't be the best one. I mean, we probably need to discuss that a little more, because to really understand what it is that you'd like to see, because we want to be responsive but we need some as much flexibility. We feel we need as much flexibility as possible to handle all the tugs and pulls we've got on our business every day.
And I do appreciate the change of director audits. I mean, I reviewed when there was a change in the chancellor's office. I reviewed that change of director audit. Mm-hmm. They hardly found anything. I think they asked the former chancellor to reimburse the state for some cell phone charges, but that doesn't mean you aren't going to find something, and those are kind of important things.
Yeah, and Senator Warren, that's what we're just discussing, is what sort of information would you see as valuable, I guess. You know, we do it every day, and we have a different perspective. So that's why we're here discussing it. We're here to try to respond to information needs, and if this is not a good provision, then fine. If it is, then fine, too. I mean, that's okay. We've got there for a reason.
Well, I'll ask Senator Metzger to work with Ms. Richardson and yourselves, and if any of us have any input, we'll let you know.
It's a great discussion. I mean, it really gets down to accountability and how's the best, what do we need to be looking at, and how do we need to report that. So
we're all about accountability here in this building. Okay, great. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate that foray into our general government area of our committee. And there is no further testimony on this bill, so I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 70, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 72. I'm so glad I have the big gavel back instead of that little puny one.
You can thank me for that one, for this.
Oh,
yes.
Did you make that change here?
Yes, in the first B.
Oh,
that
good.
Puny gavel was not acceptable.
Yeah, I didn't think it was either. Okay, well, you guys didn't even need to step down, because we're going to hear back from our dynamic duo.
Back.
So, Mr. Hibner, why don't you take it away in a moment, as soon as I have Ms. Richardson explain the bill to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 72 would expand the definition of who may be held accountable for loss of public funds or property. It would establish a $100 threshold and a 30-day reporting requirement by state agencies to the Secretary of State's office. And it would direct state agencies to report discovery of loss within 30 days after discovery. Sorry, and one more thing. It would direct the Division of Audits to determine whether to investigate loss within 30 days of receipt of the report from the agency.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Again, Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division, and
Elon Hassan, Legislative Policy Advisor, Secretary of State.
Okay.
Madam Chair, again, Senate Bill 72 is a reconstituted bill from a prior session. Again, we support this version because it was just like the last. But what we're really trying to do is provide some more guidance to agencies who are required to to report a loss. They've been reporting losses for some time now. We realize there really is some lack of clarity around when and how much and even who. So what we're trying to do is do that. The first provision really gets to the who needs to be reported to us. We get loss of funds for clients who may have taken some money or are not using their benefits wisely, which isn't what this bill is expected to address. This is for public employees or those tangential to public employment that have lost funds. So what we are proposing in this is that we align the definition instead of the I can't remember what it reads before the public person to more align it with what is currently in the government standards and practices definition, which seems to be a more precise definition of what we think the statute is trying to get to, which is it applies to public officials defined as a person who is serving a state agency as an officer, employee, member, agent, or otherwise, regardless of the person is compensated or not. Just so there's some clarity around who the agencies need to be reporting these losses as they pertain to them. The second one just establishes a threshold, a dollar amount threshold, which is somewhat arbitrary, $100. We've got folks that are reporting $25 losses. We've got agencies that they consider it immaterial, if it's a couple thousand. We didn't think it was that material. So what we would like to do is just make it very clear that any loss of $100 that is by effect of a newly defined person will be reported to us, so we know about it. It also establishes a timeline, which within 30 days of discovery of the loss, it needs to be reported to us. Again, practice is sometimes it's almost instantaneous, and sometimes it's a year later when we happen to ask, have you had any losses as a part of our standard opinion on it? So we'd like to put some more definition around that, just put that requirement that it reported to us. And then to tweak our requirement a little bit is in number four, which we have a 30-day requirement to make a determination as to whether we're going to be doing an investigation on a loss, which is a good thing. I mean, we need to have parameters around those sorts of things, too, but more times than not, an investigation cannot be concluded in 30 days, especially when there's some criminality involved. Some of the stuff we're doing now around these sorts of issues, once you're talking to a DA and FBI, and who knows, it can be a couple years. So to meet that requirement just doesn't seem reasonable. However, we can certainly make a determination within 30 days. And that's kind of what that tweak is hoping to get to. So those are the provisions of the bill. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Okay.
To that.
I noticed that Senator Cruz voted no against this bill when it was on the floor in the Senate. Senator Cruz and Senator Morse, I don't know if you gentlemen remember this bill.
Not a clue.
I mean, it was in my committee last session, and I don't really have a recollection of it either. But if you don't have a clue, you're going to be starting from a fresh, clean slate here. So I was going to ask either of you if you had any objections to what they're proposing. Senator Morse?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for pointing that out. That did not escape me either. I'm wondering if you could explain the difference between Senate Bill 157 and this bill from last session. You said it's similar, but...
Oh, I'm sorry. It should be exactly...
Oh, it is exactly
the same. All we did was take the prior bill and ask Ledge Council to reintroduce it.
Actually, Ms. Richardson points out there is one change.
Madam Chair, if I may, there was an additional section added to which the definition of public officer is changed to public official, and that's in ORS 291.226, and that regulation is with regard to budget item to replace lost and unrecovered public funds or property. So I believe it's seeking to have consistency in the use of that term.
That's correct, yeah.
But that's the only change that I noticed.
Okay. Senator Cruz is sort of sighing here. I think there's a question coming.
No. I'm just trying to sift through my memory.
Well, because you're, that's hard to do. I think what I want to do is, good thing we aren't going to pass this bill today, because I want to give at least my two colleagues that did vote no an opportunity to maybe see if they have notes hanging around from last session with regard to that bill. I actually, as you were testifying, I appreciate the fact that there were no standards that people were making up whenever they would report. If they lost $5 or $5,000, they'd decide to report or not. Also, that they didn't have any timeline for reporting the loss. I think that's critically important. And I understand your requirement that you need to go outside the 30 days, but you will, sort of like the GSPC, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, they have to make some kind of a preliminary finding.
Precisely.
And say where they're going from here. You're still able to do that. Mm-hmm. You're just extending that time to come to a final determination.
Correct, Chair Walker. We would still hold ourselves to that 30 days to make a determination as whether it's something we should be investigating or not, and
okay,
look for the resources to do that, and then it's from that moment forward from when we make that determination is when the clock starts.
Know that I still have my bill file from this bill because it was in my committee. I probably made notes, but they all went somewhere out of the building in a box. So I don't know where the Legislative Administration Committee carted those all off. But
AP's probably got them by now.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Because I make
probably have in our state archives.
And but I know that I voted for the bill in committee, so I must not have had an issue with it, and it all makes sense to me. But as I said, I want to give these folks some time. And Senator Cruz has a question.
How many reports are you getting now, and how many more do you think you would be getting? I'm sure that would be anecdotal at this point, but.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, we probably get a couple dozen a year.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'd like to add that certainly when we talk to agencies about, you know, reporting these things, it certainly isn't for a lack of interest on their part to meet the mandate. We just thought that providing a little more definition would make it easier for them to understand what it is they're supposed to be doing.
Okay, so
but they certainly are willing to.
See, you're not assuming a huge workload increase with this bill, then?
I wouldn't anticipate it, no.
But it did go to, there was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there a subsequent referral on this bill?
No. No. Okay. If I may, Madam Chair, the fiscal note that came with it last time had really no kind of bottom line due to not really having it, not really being able to predict how it would affect the number of reports. But I assume that we'll get a fiscal note with this as well this time.
Okay. Senator Morse?
Madam Chair, my records are gone. Okay, we cleaned things out. And on the basis of what I see here, I have no objections.
Okay. Okay.
Nor do I. I'm just... there may have been a bigger picture issue involved at the time.
I'm thinking that because...
looking at some other issues involved.
I'm looking at the people who voted no, and they were all of one particular party. So, it may have been some other issue.
Yes,
I don't know. But I think we're okay with this bill, but we can't have a public... we can't have a vote on it today because we don't have a work session. But we'll bring it back pretty quickly and... move it out.
Very good.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Great.
You didn't ask me, Madam Chair.
Sorry, Senator Wesson. Well, you didn't vote no on the bill. Do you have a question?
You didn't vote on the bill.
You were excused.
He was absent.
Yeah, you were absent.
Why were you absent?
Yeah.
He mostly is. So.
I'm okay with the bill, but I have a problem with Elon. I mean, does that make a difference?
No, you can bring that up later in another bill.
I can build something.
All right, great. Well, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 72 because there was no one else signed up to testify. And by the way, if anybody wants to testify on some of these things, you can sign up over on the side table over there.
This woman's been wanting to pick
me. Yeah.
This gal's been picking. She just walked down.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right, well, we are going to move to our last bill. We're going to switch gears again. Colleagues, I know you're capable of it because we're going back to education. We are going to go back to education and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 214. which I will have Dana Richardson talk about what that bill does, and then we'll start calling people up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 214, charter schools operated by school districts currently are exempt from the requirement to be a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Under this bill, they would lose that exemption. They would be required to be nonprofit organizations.
Okay. And who do we have to testify here? I have Randy Harnish and Joni Gillis. Am
Joni,
I correct?
Yes.
Good.
Yes, you are.
Okay, take it away and tell us who you're from, where you're from.
Okay. Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joni Gillis, and I am with the Oregon Department of Education. I'm here to testify in support of the proposed legislation before you, Senate Bill 214. I would like to give a very brief summary of the current state of charter schools in Oregon and then turn it over to Randy Harnish, who will speak to the specifics of this bill. In May 1999, Oregon became the 35th state to enact charter school legislation. Over the past 7.5 years, the creation of charter schools has steadily increased throughout the state. Currently, we have 70 charter schools educating over 9,000 students. Charter schools are located in 44 school districts in 23 counties. They are created both by external developers as well as school districts who are looking for additional learning opportunities for their students. Charter schools in Oregon are as diverse as the communities in which they are located. Charter schools educate students in both rural and urban areas, target a variety of age and grades, and have a plethora of curricula, dual language immersion, Waldorf methodology, arts technology, credit recovery, and Montessori are just a few examples. We can make available for each of you the 2006-2007 charter school directory that is published by the Department of Education. This publication contains information about the demographics, the mission, the goals, curriculum, assessment methods, and other details about each of our 70 charter schools. I will now turn this presentation over to my colleague, Randy Harnish.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. I'm Randy Harnish with the Department of Education. We wanted to spend a minute or two talking to you about Senate Bill 214. A charter school operates under a charter, and a charter is nothing more than a contract. And a contract, just by our common understanding of it, implies two parties agreeing to do certain things. You can't have one hand shake itself and create a contract. There is an exemption in the law currently for school districts from the requirement that to create a charter, that the entity be, the school district be established as a nonprofit organization under Oregon law and as a tax-exempt organization under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. And I believe that exemption was put in place to recognize the fact that school districts in and of themselves as legal entities in Oregon are already tax-exempt. However, we were faced over the last couple of years with a situation with a school district that was creating its own charter school and had taken advantage of this exemption. This case ended up going to Marion County Circuit Court, and one of the issues that the superintendent argued in that case was the superintendent of public instruction, was that we questioned the legitimacy of the charter given the fact that even in light of that exemption, there was a contract that was created and signed on both sides by the same local school district board. Well, the judge in that case said, and it's in the written testimony that we gave you, these provisions seem to imply, these provisions meaning the entirety of the Oregon's charter law in Chapter 338, these provisions seem to imply the need for two legally distinct entities, a sponsor and a charter governing body. However, the plain text of the law, referring to that exemption, says that you don't have to be an Oregon nonprofit and a 501c3 tax-exempt organization. One of the sub-requirements of a 501c3 is that you be a charitable corporation, and a charitable corporation must be governed by its own legal entity, its own governing board. So the judge said, even though the entirety of Chapter 338, it makes sense that there be two entities, two sides to the contract, the law seems to say otherwise. So what we would like to suggest is that we remove that exemption and require all charter schools, regardless of who they are developed by, to have to comply with those three requirements: that they be approved by a sponsor, that they be an Oregon nonprofit, and that they have applied for tax-exempt status under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, including the requirement that there be a separate governing board for that, the charter school itself. Ultimately, this is a question, we believe, of accountability in return for, or actually flexibility in return for increased accountability. And you can't have accountability if you've got a contract that doesn't have the requisite two parts, the checks and balances to make sure that the terms of the contract are met. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz,
thank
and
you,
then
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Morse.
How would this change impact, for example, Camas Valley, where the whole district went charter?
Senator Walker and Senator Cruz, my understanding is that the Camas Valley has become a charter district. Is that correct? In that case, we would still believe that there be a local school district board that acts as sponsor, and that there would be a separate board. Now, obviously, there could be a lot of crossover, and there could be folks serving on both boards, but that there really needs to be that legal entity on the other side of the agreement in order to execute a meaningful contract.
Sure. Just mm-hmm. a follow-up. I mean, because if you're dealing with a place like Camas Valley where there are very few people and you have very few people that can do this sort of thing, it seems like it could be creating an unnecessary burden upon those wishing to volunteer to participate. I mean, that was the first thing that came to my mind when I saw this, because that happens to be in my district. But, I mean, that would be a concern.
Okay. Did you have a response, Ms. Gillis? You look like you do.
I do, Chair Walker, Senator Cruz. I believe in the case of Camas Valley and Paisley and a few of our other districts that have charter schools, or the whole district's the charter school, they have developed a small advisory group that is specific to, that deals with just charter school issues, at least that's what I'm familiar with. So I think it would be formalizing that and making application for the nonprofit, and I know that it's a small advisory group, and like Randy said, there's some crossover. There might be two or three board members and then a few other local citizens.
There's paperwork involved in becoming a
yes.
501c3.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a simple matter. Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would this statute, if enacted, prohibit a school district from initiating and sponsoring and operating a charter school?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, no. It would just require that a charter school that was operated or developed by a school district to be governed by its own separate board rather than the local board acting in both roles without constituting a separate board. So, in short answer, no. A local district board would continue to have the opportunities and the options under the charter school law as they do now.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. So a court case is telling you this is why you're here. Three branches of government here. All right, well, I've got, unless we have any more questions of you all, I think we want to hear from Jim Green from the Oregon School Boards Association, if you'll hang out in the back in case we need you for more questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Green, you want to come forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Senate Bill 214 is an issue that they're trying to delete language I created for our school boards.
Oh, now we understand.
And in actuality, our association does support this change. And the reason is, gets to the question that Senator Cruz asked, which deals with districts who may have already done this. They didn't have to create that separate board. The reason I brought this language several sessions ago was I had school districts come to me and say, we want to create a charter school because we want to offer different things for boys and girls in our district, but we don't want to have to go through the paperwork hassle of creating a separate nonprofit board and getting 501c3 status, because they already have a board. They already are a charitable organization under the state laws and under the federal laws as a school district. So I brought this bill on their behalf, this change to the charter school language. Those districts would not have to comply with this. If you take a look at page 2 of the bill, the section before the emergency clause, section 2, lines 6 through 8, it says that the amendments of this apply only to a public charter school that begins its first operation after the effective date of the law. So Camas Valley, Senator Cruz, in your district, would not have to comply with this at the next time their contract comes up. One, they don't have enough people, as you indicated, in their community to come up with two separate boards, one for their school district board and one for their charter board. I believe we've taken care of this issue now for the school districts that had the problem with this. As long as that section of law stays in there, we're okay. You heard from Mr. Harnish from the Department of Education that charter schools are all about accountability, and that's exactly what the charter and the contract are about. Now, I've heard the arguments from the Department of Ed that you can't have one hand shake itself and come up with a deal. The deal truly is between that locally elected school board and the community. And it says real clearly in those contracts what that charter school is going to do and how kids are going to meet standards and what their achievement's going to be. I don't have a problem with the bill as it's currently written, as long as that section stays in on page 2, because for those districts that have already done it, they're going to be exempt from this requirement. They won't have to do that. For districts that want to do it, I can understand the judge's arguments from Marion County as to why they wanted to have that separate board. There may be some concern for small school districts, but I don't think it's that much of a problem to create that separate board, which gets to my next point, that we may be seeking an amendment to this bill, because as I've represented school districts across the state in negotiations with charter applicants, one of the things we're starting to see now in Oregon is charter schools wanting to branch out into other school districts. There are several in the state, and one of the districts that I represented this last year where this was a particular issue was the Albany School District in Senator Morris's district. There was a charter application that came from an existing charter school in the Lebanon School District known as the Sandridge Academy. They wanted to start another charter school in the Albany School District. One of the provisions, however, was that they didn't want to have to create a separate board for this new school in Albany. They were going to have folks who didn't reside in Albany, had no connection to the Albany School District, run this charter school out of Lebanon. That board, on my legal advice to them, said one of the provisions we want is a separate nonprofit board for the charter school in Albany. One, they wanted some connection to the community, because if you take a look at ORS Chapter 338, one of the criteria that a school board has to use in looking at a charter school application is there community buy-in to this? And the Albany School Board was willing to make the leap of faith to say, we want to start this school, but we really want a separate board that has Albany connections here. And it broke down in negotiations. Ultimately, they couldn't find a facility at Albany, but one of the other sticking points was they didn't want to have to create a separate board. Why did I give them legal advice that they should seek that? Liability purposes. If something were to happen at the Lebanon site for Sandridge Academy, would, if it's the same board running that school as running the one in Albany, if something happened in Lebanon, would the assets or state school fund dollars that Albany gave that board to run the Albany school be subject to liability should something happen? And legally, I can't tell you whether, in fact, a court would do that or not, but there's the potential. And Albany sure as heck didn't want their state school fund dollars to be at risk should something happen in the Lebanon School District. So one of the things we're looking at is an amendment to this bill, and I may have to do it on the House side. I understand you want to move legislation through, but I wanted to give you a heads up. I've spoken to the Department of Ed about this. They don't necessarily have concerns about it. I've spoken to Karen Hikas, who represents one entity of charter school organizers. Their group is very supportive of the idea of requiring each charter school to have its own separate nonprofit board, because that's what we thought we created in this. And as you know, Madam Chair, sometimes we have to be very specific in the language we want to put in bills, and we will be seeking an amendment to do that. The other thing that is a bit of a concern to us is if you have academies, and right now the Arthur Academy, which does great things for kids in charter schools, is currently operating in Portland, Woodburn, Reynolds, and I believe one other district up in the metro area. I can't remember right now. But they have one board overseeing each one of these charter schools. They're currently in violation of the public meetings law, because public meetings law is one of the laws that applies to charter schools. Public meetings law say that if you're a board and you have authority over a specific entity, you must hold your meetings in the region in which that entity is. Arthur Academy is currently only holding its board meetings in Reynolds, so that no one from Woodburn has a say in what goes on in the Woodburn Academy. And we pointed that out to them. They say, well, we'll work on that, but I think one way to clean that up is to say every charter school that's created from here on out, so it wouldn't affect those folks, but every charter school created from here on out should have its own separate nonprofit board. It's accountability. It gets connections to the community, which I know two school districts, Sweet Home and Albany, had concerns about with regard to some of the charter schools.
Well,
I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sure I may have raised some.
Well, yes, you did. And we're not sending a bill over to the House to get amended. We're going to fix it here. So if you're going to amend something, you need to get it started drafting. We're not going to even act on bills in the chamber until March. So we've got plenty of time. But I am concerned. Why? I mean, you say on the one hand this isn't really that big of a deal, but yet you want to exempt the people that have already done it. So I'm not quite sure why you want to do that.
Madam Chair, I think one of the things that may have to come up, and I was thinking about this actually this morning on the way into work, is to exempt those folks because it was such a huge issue with those folks we dealt with at the Albany and Sweet Home School District, or do you say at your next renegotiation of your contract, because contracts are good right now in Oregon law from 1 to 5 years, at your next renegotiation, it's an issue you got to deal with. That's what we've told districts to do with these folks currently, is to say when you come up for renegotiation, require these folks to have their own separate board.
Well, that's
And I'm happy to go there.
Yeah, and I would be interested in exploring that with the committee here, because that's not what it says in Section 2. It just says they're totally exempt. There's no discussion about when you come up for renewal. But Senator Cruz has a whole district that fits into this scenario, so I'd actually like to hear from him on that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to bring that up, and you know, Jimmy said, you know, Camas Valley, and we'll use that once more. They're okay because they're grandfathered in, but I could give you a real world scenario that may or may not happen. That would be Glendale, and because I've talked to members of the South Umpqua School Board, and under some conditions, they would let them leave. Okay, chances are they would at that point become charter, but they would be a district charter again, and it's basically no different. Glendale, maybe slightly larger, but not much larger than Camas Valley. And so you're, to a degree, you're saying from your perspective the problem's solved because we've grandfathered folks in that aren't going to have to jump through these the 501c3 hoops and all that sort of stuff. But I guess my concern is if it's okay because those who have done it are grandfathered in, it really gives no remedy for those who may be yet to come. And I'm speaking specifically of very small school districts. And, you know, a large school district that wants to form a charter, they've got administrative people, they've got everything they need. Jumping through hoops is no big deal. They do it all the time. But for these small school districts, it could be an undue burden for them trying to do education in a way that better fits their community. And so I still have a concern. I mean, you know, this provision, great for Camas Valley. What about Glendale? So I think there may still be some future concerns for these really small remote school districts that we're adding a burden to.
And Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, you're referring to a provision in ORS Chapter 338 that lets a single building district convert to charter school status. I think we have three or four now in the state. And perhaps the solution to that is to exempt those folks from that requirement. In those small communities, because we have them in Ione, out of Morrow County. We have them in Paisley and Lake County and Camas Valley, and I believe there's one other. I'm sure Joni Gillis from the department will remind me as soon as I leave the stand what that other one is. But if you can exempt those small communities from that requirement, that may be one of the things. The biggest hoop that these school districts have to jump through, or that entities jump through, is the forming of that 501c3, because that's an IRS. Creating a nonprofit corporation in the state of Oregon, I believe it's still only $15 with the Secretary of State's office, articles of incorporation, bylaws. And to be honest with you, Senator, when those school districts looked at doing this, I gave them the template to do that and said, you got to come up with the $15. But here's your articles of incorporation and bylaws to do that. To get your solution is maybe you extend that exemption to those school districts who are wanting to become a charter district.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and quite honestly, my issue isn't the Albany School District or 4J or anything like that. It's these real small, remote ones that, and so if we can make provisions for those folks to have the flexibility without the burden, I think I'd be okay with this.
And Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it fits in with ORS Chapter 338 because we do allow districts that are a single building school district to convert to charter school status. So we've already created an exemption for small school districts, because if you're a district that has more than one building, you can't become a charter district.
I see. So when you're talking about a single building, single school
it
house.
It is one campus.
One school house.
It is one campus.
Which is what Camas Valley is.
It's so. I own Camas Valley, Paisley, they got one building.
That's tiny. That's Little House on the Prairie tiny.
Well, Madam Chair, we have divergence in this state of the Portland School District that has 50,000 students and the Troy School District that has two.
Mm. Wow. Well, I want to explore that a little bit more, and we'll have the department come up here in a sec, but I want to make sure, does anyone else have any questions? Senator Morse?
With respect to the governance issue, now the Arthur Academy has one governing board, and they contract them with more than one district.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that's correct. They have separate contracts with, I believe, the four districts they're currently operating in.
Well, Madam Chair, I would suggest that the language that creates the mandate for a governing board would need to be very thoughtfully crafted. When you have one corporate entity with essentially divisions,
and
how that board,
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that was part of the negotiations we did with the Albany folks, because they had already argued to us, well, we've got the separate board, and I said, well, that's fine. Create some sort of sub-board under that body that Albany deals with, that they're the ones that are locally they deal with it. And they initially said they'd take a look at that, and then they came back and said no. I mean, the negotiations broke down because one of the other conditions Albany put on them was find a facility by X date. They couldn't find that facility, but it's still an issue that we had with this group. And I agree with you. We'd want to structure it so that you don't want to put too much of a burden on them, but I can see Albany's position here. They want to deal with local folks, and they also wanted to be sure that the liability issue was taken care of. But I believe you could craft language that would say, for the Arthur Academies, for the Sand Ridges, for those folks out there, they just have to create some other type of board for that entity. But it was one of the sticking points we had with the Albany School District and the Sand Ridge Academy folks who wanted to create that Albany school.
Your point's well taken. If someone's in Woodburn and they have to travel all the way to wherever it was that the Arthur Academy has their meetings, that's not fair. That's not being responsive.
And, Madam Chair, it actually violates the public meetings law that charter schools have to comply with.
Uh-huh.
Because the governing body under public meetings law is supposed to meet within the boundaries of where they are. Arguably, they're within the boundaries of the Woodburn School District. They should meet within those boundaries, but they're not currently.
I don't like the answer that, well, we'll work on that. I mean, I'd like a more proactive answer that we'll have this solved by such and such a time. So I think maybe we'll have some more discussion about that, too. Senator Westland has a question.
Just a clarification for the record, because Mr. Green was very strident in saying, you know, those one building school districts, and then you slipped in one campus. It's one campus school district. I mean, Mitchell has a big old school district, and then off to the side, they now have a smaller, set of, what are those, temporary classrooms, modular classrooms. You can argue, oh, that's two buildings. You don't qualify.
And Madam Chair, Senator Westland, we dealt with that issue when we looked at, I believe it was the Ione School District, because they essentially have what was once thought of as two buildings, but they have a breezeway that connects those buildings, and it was determined that that is a single-building school district. I think you could argue that in the Mitchell instance, in your district, Senator, actually, I think that's Senator Farioli's district, but I think you could argue that Mitchell, with those temporary buildings, because they had to bring them in because, and I know in Mitchell, it was because part of their building was falling down around
right.
them, mm-hmm. that they needed to bring those facilities in, that you could argue it is a single building. I believe in ORS Chapter 338. And I could find it if you give me a moment, that it says a single building school district.
Depends how you define building.
Well, a breezeway worked.
just connect two and you have one. So.
Well, I'm going to have the department come back up and chat. And actually, you could just stay there, Mr. Green, and they can sit alongside you there.
And Senator Westland, Madam Chair, I did find the provision in ORS Chapter 338. It's ORS Chapter 338.035, Subsection 5, Subsection B. A school in a school district that is composed of only one school may become a public charter school.
Okay. So it doesn't say building.
It does not say building.
School.
It says school.
So the school could branch out.
Three buildings.
Yeah, lots of buildings.
Right. Salem Kaiser could not do it because of the previous part in there, but Ione was allowed to do it.
Okay. Do Mr. Harnish or Ms. Gillis, do you have a response to that?
Chair Walker, exactly what are we? The.
I'm sorry.
What was the?
You agree with the definition that it's just a school?
A school,
and
yes.
We're not talking buildings.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah,
okay.
I think that goes to the who's, you know, how many administrators and whether you've got two principals and two different, quote, schools, but yeah.
Okay. Okay, so do you have any response to some of the conversation that we've had up here about some of these concerns that we have? I'm particularly concerned about the public meetings violation and maybe exempting the districts that become a district in this instance, but not exempting anybody else, because that's a pretty broad exemption under Section 2.
Senator Walker, I think we'd be very open to working with Jim and others in crafting some amendments. I think it makes perfectly good sense to separate out the single school, single building charters that Senator Cruz mentioned. And treat them a little bit differently than the balance of the charter schools. As to the kind of the franchise question and the charter, the requirement that the boards, or that each charter school site have its own separate board, again, I think that's something that we would certainly consider, and I don't see any reason at this point why we would oppose that, but it would probably take a little bit more conversation mm-hmm. to determine if that's something that we would be neutral on or support.
Okay. Ms. Gillis, do you have any response?
No, I think
Well, I do want to have some more conversation on that. Maybe I want to have the Arthur Academy come in and explain their position. Are there others like that, Mr. Green?
Madam Chair, the only other one that I can think of that is currently operating two facilities in two separate districts with one board is the Sandridge folks from Lebanon. They are
okay.
currently operating one in the Lebanon schools, which has been a successful school.
Okay.
And they just opened one this fall in the Sweet Home School District. They were looking to expand that to the Albany District.
Okay.
But for the variety of reasons that I've already
right,
testified to, they couldn't do that.
Right.
And in the interest of full disclosure, you know, there are two groups out there that represent charter schools. There's Karen Hikas, who I know many of you on the committee know,
mm-hmm.
and then there's Rob Kramer's group.
Right.
And Mr. Kramer and I have had significant discussions on this issue. He was representing the folks from the Sandridge Academy, and we had a disagreement of minds there on that issue of a separate board. So if you want to have a broader discussion, it may be beneficial to hear that side.
Uh-huh. And doesn't Mr. Kramer have something to do with the Arthur Academies?
Yes, Madam Chair. I believe he serves on their board.
I thought so. Senator Metzger, you have a question?
Well, just one question, Mr. Green. That's different. As we talk about these things, you start reading things and
mm-hmm.
About the nonprofits. So I was just wondering, on lines 13, 14, I mean, since the idea is to make sure that they're all nonprofit and qualify, 501(c). The language says to they meet the qualification if they've applied to qualify as an exempt organization. It never says what happens if the IRS denies it. It doesn't say you have to be one. It says you just have to apply. I mean, is that boilerplate language, or have you had somebody applied for an exemption like this and then been denied? Because it doesn't say you have to be one. It just says you have to apply.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, there's a two-part question there, and I'll give you a two-point answer. In 1999, when we wrote this law, we were crafting it after several other states' laws that had been in place. There were 20-some-odd states in front of us that had done this. One of the reasons it's have applied rather than you get it is it can take over a year from the IRS to make that determination.
Understood.
So we wanted to just ensure that the person understood they wanted to get that. The reason it's in the law, just for background purposes for you, one, if folks give to school districts now, if you donate a computer to a school district now, you get a tax deduction for that. Mm-hmm. If you gave to a charter school, you don't unless they have that 501(c)(3) status. Mm-hmm. So when we were negotiating the bill, we wanted to make sure folks could donate to this and get that break.
Right.
The second part to your question is, in the state of Oregon, no one has been denied that, but it does take over a year, mm-hmm. and for folks who wanted to start their charter school, that seemed like an awful big delay.
Right.
It's a paperwork hassle, Senator, to file for that, if many of you have done this with the IRS. Mm-hmm. What they do, however, is they send you a letter saying, we've received your paperwork, you will receive a determination letter within X time as to whether you've been granted that status or not. I am not aware of any charter school applicant who sought 501(c)(3) status in the state who has not been granted that status.
Okay. So that, if I could just follow up one thing, mm-hmm. To be clear then. So, and as a result, you don't see there would be any, since this is going to be tweaked anyway, any necessity of adding something that at some point along the line you have to have actually gotten it. I mean, you feel it's okay just to qualify, I mean, just to apply based on
Madam Chair,
the laws of Oregon, which is another requirement.
So. Madam Chair, Senator Mentor, I don't think we need to tweak it. As a matter of fact, when I represent districts and I'm giving them advice on this, one of the things I always say to them is that you're contingent on becoming a charter school once you get that determination, and generally that's a long enough window of time to get that, because one of the things I advise my school boards to always see when they're going to start a charter school with someone is, let me see your bylaws and articles of incorporation for your nonprofit, mm-hmm. and once you get that determination letter from the IRS, give it to us, so that there is that accountability loop, because as Mr. Harnish said, we're talking about accountability. I always instruct our boards that I represent, do that accountability loop, because you as legislators said it's important to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Your bylaws and articles of incorporation, mm-hmm. and some sort of 501(c)(3) status. I don't think we need to tweak it right now, Senator.
Okay. Well, committee, I think what I'd like to do is bring this bill back, notify Karen Hikas and Rob Kramer that we have some concerns that we'd like to have them come in and address, and then also work on an amendment to perhaps, I don't know, how are you all feeling about this issue about the single school district? I think we all sort of felt we had some concern about that, but it is 10:15. We're not in work session, so I'll just give you a comment, Mr. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I think there was general agreement that to look for some accommodation there, and I'd be more than interested in that. I'm also interested in Mr. Green's amendment, what that's going to look like, and how you guys feel about that. So, and I would also like to hear from Kramer and company. So,
mm-hmm. And Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very appreciative of the work that's been done to accommodate the existing single district charter school districts. But who among us is capable of predicting the future? I think we need to have some language in there that allows for districts in the future to go forward that may want to, charter under the whole district. And we can't put any impediments on that. I sense a little more difficulty on the 501(c)(3), maybe just the nonprofit contracting laws allow that to happen expeditiously. We're joined with, by Charles Starr, former Senator Charles Starr here, and I went back to ask him if he wanted to testify, and he graciously demurred, but he just indicated to me that he just spent $3,000 and a considerable amount of time getting his 501c3 status. So this is an issue for districts, and I don't think we should do anything that stands in the way of the creativity and desires of a given district.
And Madam Chair, if I might just clarify my comments real quickly. In my comments in requiring a charter school board to have its own separate nonprofit board, we didn't necessarily have a problem and don't necessarily have a problem with the overall board being one 501c3 status. Mm-hmm. I don't want to require each charter school to go out and get that 501c3 status. What I'd like those charter school folks to do is to have that board that local school board can deal with that's local. Senator Westland's exactly right. Former Senator Starr is exactly right. It can cost a lot of money to get that determination letter because they're not easy forms to fill out. My only concern is that separate nonprofit board, one, for the breakup of liability, but I don't want to have to charge anybody an additional $3,000. My point is just on the nonprofit board, not on the 501c3 status. I think you can use an umbrella 501c3 fine and not have any liability purposes. It's that separate board that caused concern for us.
Okay. Well, we clearly have some more work to do on this bill. Did you have a question, Senator Morris?
I agree. This whole issue of governance and piercing the corporate veil is a very complicated issue. I've dealt with it in my personal business life in structuring organizations. So if we go down that road, it's a very complicated and a thoughtful process to make sure that.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris takes me back to my second year of law school with professional corporate organizations and piercing the corporate veil. I'm having bad flashbacks to my bar exam.
And I hear about this all the time in bankruptcy court when we need to pierce the corporate veil to get at the assets. So, anyway, thank you all very much. And I do want to recognize Senator Charles Starr, who joined us in the back today. Appreciated your work when you were here on the committee.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Mr. Green has carefully avoided a pressing question today.
Mm-hmm.
He has not in any way alluded to his vast knowledge of baseball, and I need to know when pitchers and catchers are going to report. How many days till pitchers and catchers report?
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, I don't know the number of days. I do have the date in my calendar.
It is 23.
23 days.
Get with the program.
All right, gentlemen.
Thank you for correcting me.
We're going to close the public hearing. Wait a minute, Senator Morris.
But just very quickly, in light of the discussions that we've heard today from OSA and the cost to students of education, the price, the other side of that equation is managing costs within the universities. And I would like to share a document from the Association of Governing Boards and Universities that has some very good data and information in it that I think would be good background information. It's at a national perspective, but this whole issue of how do universities manage and govern to control costs is part of the equation that we need to address as well. And I think this is a pretty good starter.
All right. That doesn't have anything to do with Senate Bill 214.
No, excuse me.
Let me close the public hearing on that.
I apologize,
close
Madam
the public
Chair.
Hearing on Senate Bill 214. Thank you. And I appreciate that, Senator Morris. We talked about this, and this is on my reading list at the beach this weekend. Where I'm going to get away for a couple of days. And I do hope, colleagues, that you all have a chance to read it as well. Anything else for the good of the order before we check out? Okay, thank you all, committee. We are adjourned. We'll see you on Tuesday.